Welcome back to the program. Espionage, by its very nature, exists in a kind of moral twilight. The decisions spies often have to make may be repugnant to their own moral codes or sensibilities, but consistent with a view of the greater good of the country or society. But what happens when this circle can't be squared, when the work simply cannot be justified within any moral framework, and in fact seems both wrong and inconsistent with the greater societal good? Then, more than ever, it takes true courage to rise, to speak up, to do better. This is in many ways what our guest today has done. Glenn Carl spent 23 years in the clandestine service of the Central Intelligence Agency, where he worked in a number of overseas posts on four continents and in Washington. He's worked on terrorism at various times since the mid-1980s and has worked extensively on Balkan, Afghan, Central American, and European political security and economic issues. His last position at the CIA was Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats on the National Intelligence Council. He retired from the CIA in March 2007. He holds a BA in Government from Harvard, an MA in European Studies and International Economics from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. It is my pleasure to welcome Glenn Carl here to talk about his book, The Interrogator, An Education. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. One of the things that you talk about is that although you spent 23 years in the CIA, that nothing during that period really prepared you for what you were going to face with respect to some of the things we'll talk about regarding the war on terror.
Well, that's true. The agency, as we call the CIA, is not in the business of interrogating people, really, or wasn't until after 9/11. My job as an operations officer, which means what people conventionally think of as a CIA officer in the field, was to find people who I could convince to spy for the United States against their country. But that's not the same job, really, as interrogating somebody.
And with respect to the agency itself, had its mission changed or had these things changed individually over this period of time? Or was there a broader sea change within the organization, within the agency?
Well, I think both things were happening. The agency has always had a covert action or a special activities division as part of its functions in the operations side where I worked. So we always have done more than just, I shouldn't say just, more than the running spies that I talked about a moment ago. But that wasn't a large part of the agency's work. After 9/11, with the ramp up of what came to be called the War on Terror, there was a huge increase in that kind of function, and it is in that area of the agency and operations that the interrogations occurred. So that was a major change in resource allocation and activities, yes.
Was this a change that was ever clearly spelled out and articulated by the leadership of the agency?
I hesitate how to answer that. I mean, the agency, during the years of President Clinton's administration, was very clearly focused on the threat from Islamic-inspired terrorism, and al-Qaeda specifically. It's a fact that President Clinton and George Tenet increased by orders of magnitude. That's hundreds of percent, thousands of percent, the resources devoted to counterterrorism work. So that was a change well before 9/11. After 9/11, the war on terror defined almost all of American foreign policy and intelligence activities. So the trend continued to the point where it became almost all-encompassing.
One of the things you talk about in that regard is that there were really some conceptual errors and some real mistakes made as that counterterrorism program started to evolve, and as there were these geometric increases in the amount of counterterrorism work, all of those early mistakes were magnified.
Oh, absolutely. And it's easy to say in hindsight, and it's easy to be a critic. It's very hard to get things right. So I have tremendous compassion for my colleagues and for any policymaker and, frankly, for myself for the errors that I make. But we all make mistakes. That's okay. The challenge is that once an institution comes to adopt a certain perspective, it's extremely difficult to change it. And, in fact, our assessment of the terrorist threat became, I would argue, even progressively over the years, progressively two-dimensional. Whereas before, I think there was a good understanding that there were multiple problems with, that had different twists and permutations. As the war on terror came to have a name and become the approach, we simplified things and then got a lot of things wrong, and we didn't know it.
What were some of the mistakes that we made early on?
Well, after 9/11, in particular, the definition of the enemy. I mean, Sun Tzu, 3,000 years ago, said the step one in war fighting is know your enemy, and we didn't. So we came to think that Al Qaeda was a growing, global, coherent, strategic, nearly existential threat for the United States and the West. Now, the rhetoric of jihadists is horrifying and would substantiate that. But if one were to read the alarming passages of any religious text, one would get a different view and a wrong view, in most cases, of the true multiple organic conflicted nature of any religious perspective. And that's what happened. So we came to simplify things and view them as 10 feet tall, when in fact they are the extremists and a symptom of social disruption rather than actually the first drivers of it.
What about in the way counterterrorism efforts were set up, the bureaucratic structure that changed in order to accommodate these changes in the agency?
Yeah, well, I have some sympathy for policymakers because after 9/11, certainly the widows of the victims of 9/11 demanded action, and all Americans did. And one can't simply say, as a policymaker, well, you know, we're doing really well and we're working really hard. There has to be some sort of response. And the classic response is to create a new bureaucratic procedure or a new institution. And that's what we've done. And most of the institutional changes after 9/11 are monuments to Osama bin Laden and haven't made things dramatically better. The one exception is the National Counterterrorism Center, and there it has done some effective work. But frankly, it's just a recreation of what the CIA was doing before. And then the other institutions, the Department of Homeland Security, is this unwieldy mess. And I question whether it makes sense to have such wildly disparate government agencies together when their missions are not the same.
Right. Was there something inherently contradictory about this bureaucracy that started to grow up around counterterrorism and really what the essential work of espionage was, which is much more of a freelance kind of operation?
Well, I'd put it a little, I'd frame it a little differently. I think one of the challenges, disadvantages that counterterrorist institutions have had, the CIA and especially, and the FBI, is that we are, because the agency and the FBI are government institutions, we are hierarchical and bureaucratic by nature. That's not necessarily a bad thing. There are reasons for that, and it makes sense. However, a terrorist group is a much flatter organization. It doesn't have as much of a hierarchy. Al-Qaeda accepted it. Al-Qaeda did. So a terrorist organization can be flexible as well as really small. And that gives them, in some ways, an advantage over something like the CIA, which has to follow procedures and has a chain of command and is hierarchical. I think that's been part of the challenge, is how to become flatter organizationally and then operationally quicker in our responses.
And in terms of the work that you had to do after 9/11, talk a little bit about how that operation, how the agency changed, how the chain of command altered slightly, as you talk about, and why it made it more difficult for some of the assignments that you had to undertake.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned early, my job was the standard job of the bread and butter of the Directorate of Operations, and that is to identify people who have secrets that the United States would like to know and then convince the people to give them to me or to steal them. That's the core mission of the CIA. The covert action, the counterterrorism stuff, also is a mission, but it's a much smaller one. And the shift came after 9/11, and the covert action, counterterrorism actions came to dominate our activities. That slides us toward two kinds of things, of operations that are not ours traditionally. One would be law enforcement and counterterrorism actions that the FBI engages in, and the other is paramilitary kind of operations where we would work closely with or do the kinds of things that the special forces do. We can do both of those functions, but they aren't the core mission. So when I was assigned to interrogate this Al-Qaeda fellow, I was representative of the agency. The agency doesn't do interrogations, or it didn't prior to 9/11. And so I had to figure out, well, okay, how do we do this? And the institution fell back on what it believed were lessons and procedures learned from the Korean War, which were hideous, actually, and wrong. And I had to work out, well, how do you interrogate somebody?
Did anybody in the agency speak up and say, maybe there's a more modern, more contemporary way to approach this?
Good question. I don't know the answer. I wasn't privy to the the top officers' discussions, but I think the answer is no. I think it went as follows. The administration said, go and take down Al Qaeda, and we set out to do that. And when we captured some members of the organization, our job is to obtain intelligence, so we have to interrogate them. And we thought, well, how do we do this? And we fell back on the procedures that I alluded to that derived from the Korean War and before, actually, from our enemies, from the North Koreans. And it was just sort of a default process. I had been trained 25 or going on 30 years ago now, and part of my training was to be interrogated. The scenario was that I had been taken prisoner. It's very useful training for an officer because that could happen, and there are ways to cope with what amounts to torture, with hostile interrogation. That's useful, but the craziness was that those measures were transmogrified into supposedly being the right way to obtain information, and that's not the case at all.
Right.
But that's what happened with sort of this default reflexive response without any particular thinking at the beginning of the war on terror.
How was that conveyed to you and other agency people in the field that this is what was expected in terms of these interrogations?
Well, I know I can only speak to how I experienced my professional involvement in this, and it's the first chapter of my book, actually.
Uh-huh.
I was told, listen, can you go on a business trip tomorrow? It's very important for you, it's important for the agency, and it's important for the country. That's all that I knew, and so, of course, one says yes to that. And then they said, all right, go talk to Joe Schmo, a certain person at such and such an office, and he'll brief you. So I did, and he closed the door, and he said, we've captured one of the top members of Al-Qaeda, and we are interrogating him. And then he said, you will do whatever it takes to get him to talk. Do you understand? That's verbatim what I was told. And I understood, but my response was, well, we don't do that. And the answer to that was, we do now. So that's how I was told.
And did you think that it would be effective?
Well, from the first second that I was briefed, I was instantaneously aware that this was a critical moment, the critical moment probably in my career, and I thought, and I quite consciously thought this at the time, probably a critical moment in the history of the CIA, and for that matter, the United States government post-World War II. The United States doesn't do this sort of thing, and so I said, well, we need at least a direct presidential order, and I was told that we had it. And so then I thought, well, holy smoke, what am I going to... This is my internal discussion,
mm-hmm,
not my conversation
mm-hmm.
with the fellow. What am I going to do here? There could clearly be a moment when I have to say, no, I won't do it. How do I accomplish my mission, fulfill my orders, act honorably, obey the law, and maintain integrity? From the first second, I thought I might have to address some way to handle that. So I also decided from that second I just wouldn't ever... I would never do anything physical to anyone. I just wouldn't do it. It's just not right. However, the psychological measures that I had been trained in to change someone's psychological state, I had been trained, worked, obtained information, and were not lasting. And I know I'm answering a little too long here, but the definition of what torture is, and I asked very carefully, and the definition was... any severe and lasting pain is torture. But if it is not severe and an important article and lasting, it doesn't fit the bill, meet the criteria of torture. That's a very elastic standard. So I thought, you know what? This is clearly a very murky area, and at some point I might have to say no. But at the beginning, I accepted the training I had received and from the experts that psychological measures would be effective and not torture.
And as you were processing that, as you were trying to understand in your own dialogue how you were going to respond to this, to what extent did the greater good argument enter into the equation, the broader impact, potentially, of what might come from this interrogation of a top al-Qaeda leader?
Well, this is one of the very stimulating and almost impossible challenges that an agency officer has in his career and that the agency has. As you said in your setup for our discussion, the agency is often asked to do things that present problems for a person on an individual perspective, morally or ethically, say. But that's the job, and we serve the state. And we also have to believe that the state serves, preserves, and protects our laws and constitution and society and way of life. And generally that is the case. But we exist in the gray areas where the issues are not as clear. So from the first, that's just the nature of the job. And in particular, this was the case because frequently our policies will be accepted or opposed by individual officers. But that's just life. You know, there are Republicans, Democrats, Independents. You take the oath to serve the country, not your political views. And so you just have to serve. But at some point, you might think, I cannot do this. This so transgresses my oath that I have to oppose it. And that's fortunately extremely rare, but I came to the point where I felt that was the case.
Talk about the interrogation itself before it got to the point where harsher techniques were required.
The CIA had been following this individual, whom I can't name, for a long, long time and knew huge amounts of information about him. It was a very impressive effort by my colleagues. And they decided that we had a chance to take him off the street and to neutralize this guy from his involvement with al-Qaeda. He was viewed as one of the top half dozen or so operatives in al-Qaeda. And by capturing him, and what we did essentially was to kidnap the guy, we could possibly find bin Laden. This is 2002 now, less than a year after. It's only 9 months after 9/11. Possibly find bin Laden, and at the least, seriously damage al-Qaeda as an institution. Well, that all makes a lot of sense. So we, before I had any involvement, we captured this guy, we kidnapped him, and we started to interrogate him. The interrogation only lasted about 3 days or four before I became involved. And it was just, frankly, incompetence, I'm sorry to say. But the fellow doing it before me thought that simply shouting at the guy was effective. I just thought that it was stupid. And I was able to, although I have I had zero experience in interrogation, I understand human beings and I understand how to do my job as an operations officer, and I thought that I could do it more effectively, and I managed to get myself involved.
Was there ever an attempt to reach for the agency? To reach out to others maybe outside the agency in the broader society that because of their psychological training, perhaps because of law enforcement training or whatever, might have more professional experience in the arena of interrogation?
Yes. Oh, yes. The interrogation of a high-value target, that's what we call one of the top detainees, is a very labor- and resource-intensive process. It's not just one officer, in this instance myself, sent out to be with the detainee. There's almost every agency that has any conceivable finger in the pie will be involved. So talking with the FBI and the military and other relevant agencies happened all the time. Now the FBI took a different approach to all of this, and as you probably know, Director Mueller from the beginning said he forbid. I don't know what the term, if he issued whatever order he issued, mm-hmm. He said he forbid any FBI officer to have anything to do, no involvement whatsoever with any enhanced interrogation technique. End. That's it. And the CIA instead sought legal guidance. What are we allowed to do? We will not do anything illegal. We must have guidance. And the guidance came from the famous John Yoo memoranda out of the Department of Justice, which were written at the behest of the Office of the Vice President and the White House. And it essentially amounted to, you'll do whatever you need to do to accomplish the mission as we define it, which was quite alarming.
And when you were literally confronted with really the pressure, the orders to engage in this harsher interrogation, talk a little bit about your reaction at that moment, at that time.
Well, it was always the way I mentioned it briefly before, you will do whatever it takes. It was never specific, do X, Y, or Z. It was pressure him, and the pressure was on me to pressure him. And it was for me, since I was involved in the early days of the interrogation program and issues, it was for me to work it out. There were no clear formal guidelines at that time. The agency realized that, well, we can't have people out there just sort of winging it, and quickly scrambled to develop a series of protocols, steps, and acceptable procedures. Those were being developed while I was interrogating my fellow, whom I call Captus. But they didn't exist for me, and even when they were finally elaborated, they were based upon the John Yoo Department of Justice memorandum, which authorized, you know, slapping and changes of temperature, all the psychological measures in particular that I alluded to before, which come straight out of the you know, the procedures from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm. Were you willing to engage in any of these activities?
Well, as I said, I broke it. The objective of interrogation is to, the term of art is to dislocate psychologically the detainee. And in so doing, the theory is that he becomes more willing to provide information and more malleable so that you can obtain it. And the way you dislocate someone psychologically is there are two ways. There are physical and psychological measures. The physical measures I simply wouldn't engage in at all. I wouldn't do it. The psychological measures consist of, this will sound sort of bizarre perhaps, but this is the fact, we all have unconscious reference points that are what life is on Earth. I mean, it will sound crazy, but, you know, gravity is below us and pulls us down. The sky is up. The sun rises in the east, and it does so every day. We eat three times a day. We sleep once, you know, in 24 hours for about 8 hours. Okay, well, that's normal. When you change your perceptions for all of those things, you sort of go crazy. You go crazy. It's very quick. And you do that by changing, altering the temperature and the light and the diet and the sleep rhythms and the space that you're in and your sense of perception so that you can't see anything. And if you can't see anything, you have no horizon. All of those things pretty quickly disassociate you from the world that you knew it. And I had been taught, that had happened to me in my training, and I had been taught that that stuff worked. And so I thought, well, if they say after, you know, if it happens for a couple of days and then the effects all go away, that is not torture, well, okay. Well, I found two things. One, I found that it's not acceptable, and two, I found that it doesn't work. And so after I always opposed using any measures in my fellow, but intellectually I did accept the validity at first of those things and came to oppose them progressively.
In the broader sense, what do you think are the larger consequences to the country from a public policy perspective of engaging in this kind of torture, engaging in this kind of almost primitive activity?
Well, I think it's catastrophic, and this is why I wrote the book. I didn't write this book to tell a tale of derring do and spy stuff at all. I was quite proud of my career, and the oath and the agency has an important function. Clandestinity is a legitimate, important characteristic of intelligence operations. All of that is true. I wrote the book because I take my oath very seriously and because I love my country as much as anybody else does. And when we do things that undermine the meaning of our flag and our laws and our institutions, but it's all done out of sight and yet with the support of the public, it is gravely, gravely disturbing and important to me. America is not about that. America opposes these things. That's why I took the oath. That's the country we all think we live in. And when in fact I was being ordered to do things that undermined all of that, then I thought, this is truly a serious issue, a serious crisis, and the American public needs to know what we have done to ourselves, to ourselves. If I can just go on for a little bit longer,
sure, please.
There was a poll about a month ago, 6 weeks ago maybe now, I think it was USA Today, that found, and this distills why I wrote the book. Americans 35 and above, a majority of them think, well, of course torture is un-American. Americans don't torture. We oppose it. It is wrong. Americans 35 and below, a majority of them apparently think, well, we need to do whatever it takes to protect ourselves from the bad guys. And torture, it's okay if we do it, if our guys do it to the bad guys. That's not the America that I think any of us want to live in. That's crazy.
To the extent there is this sea change in attitude, what corrosive effect do you think that it has on the body politic, on the country?
Well, I think it's really severe. I think that the programs I was involved in, what we did to ourselves, and of course to the people we were interrogating, but actually they're secondary to my concern, grave as the issues are. I think that we experienced the gravest crisis to our institutions and our values since the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans because they have slanted eyes. I mean, it's just appalling. And that our country now has accept that our laws were traduced, which we have done, because what happened? The Convention Against Torture was quite clear. The Geneva Conventions are quite clear. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, the oath I took in the CIA, all are clear. And then we have a presidential memorandum written by a hack in the Department of Justice saying, well, no, what the president orders is legal and all of this stuff is, all those laws misunderstand our entire history and society, and I, based on this memo, can tell you what to do. I find that really frightening. We are no longer a government of laws. The laws and the institutions, the checks and balances are all bypassed. The American public supports this. To me, this is the gravest crisis facing our institutions since Watergate, possibly. It's a big deal to me, and I think that we should all be really concerned. I feel badly that we misassessed the man I interrogated. That's an injustice to him. The larger problem is what we've done to ourselves.
Much of the book, or a lot of things in the book, are clearly redacted, and you've included those redactions in the book. Talk a little bit about how the agency responded to you writing this.
Well, I almost didn't include them because I was afraid that readers would be turned off by seeing a lot of black lines and think, well, you know, I can't read this. But what happened is I wrote the book to be about 100,000 words. The agency censored, redacted is their term, 40,000 words of the initial manuscript. They clearly didn't want me to write anything. You know, they would let me say the sky is blue and I love my children, but beyond that they wouldn't let me say much of anything. And so for 2 years I went back and forth writing and rewriting the text, arguing that they were taking things out that exceeded their authorization. They have the legal mandate, the CIA, to protect sources and methods. That's fair. That, you know, I shouldn't be able to say how we avoid being followed or who is spying for us. Of course not. But I argued that they took out things simply to stop me from writing the book. I at one point wrote that somebody was a gibbering fool, and they took that out. Well, I don't believe that calling somebody a fool is a secret. I wrote at one point that headquarters, my colleagues in the field, and I all disagreed, and they took that out. I mean, on and on, and at one point I said I found myself surrounded by stones, and they took that out, and then I exploded at them in this meeting. I said, look, if I sue you guys, the judge will laugh you out of court when he hears that you took out the word stones. The entire blasted world is made out of rocks, and you can't do that. And then they laughed, and they said, well, okay, you can keep the word stones. So it was, I think, way beyond their mandate to take out what they took out.
Glenn Carl, his book is The Interrogator on Education. It is just out from Nation Books. Glenn, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.